a kind of do-gooder who's been trying to reform the church and everything else I get near, the society, all my life for some unknown reason. Spent 7 years in the Freedom Movement in Chicago with Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson. I was on his staff for 5 years, business agent for 40 black contractors and all kinds of stuff. But I always got my money from the University of Chicago. And I was in a very strange position since I worked hard enough to get my tenure and then I was kind of free. They couldn't touch me, and I did all this stuff largely out of that kind of freedom. It's a very unique kind of situation. But I've also worked very, very hard, worked 17 years in one church trying to bring life to it, and did everything in the church. I spent 9 years holding ladies' coats and doing anything they asked, so I'd be chairman of the call committee and get a new minister, which we did. He couldn't make it go. His best person we could find in the country, and he could not make the church go. He got kicked upstairs to the dean of the chapel at the university, but he was a failure at this church. So I've had a lot of failures, you might say, in trying to reform the city and of Chicago. And I got interested in energy as another great issue, and began to think about it about 5 years ago. And so I'm a kind of lay person who's just worked at this. I don't have a lot of technical knowledge, but I've listened to a lot of people with technical knowledge. And I formed some convictions about it. And I'm just sharing those with you. Actually, you're kind of guinea pig, because this is a paper I got to produce for the Presbyterians as of last Wednesday of its due. But what I've been saying the last two sessions is that on the basis of my limited experience and study, we use the wrong kind of energy in the United States. And we use energy in the wrong way, and we make our decisions about energy economically and politically in the wrong way. Can't be much more pessimistic. In other words, we act immorally or unethically in relation to energy. And our use of energy, therefore, is a moral or an ethical issue. Furthermore, we have developed an energy technology and an energy producing, processing, and distributing system that undermines democratic politics, so that energy becomes a political issue. It becomes a political issue in terms of its own life. Now there are political problems in relation to energy in terms of a national program, but this is a political issue in a different sense. And thirdly, we want too much energy. Our whole way of being, our lifestyle is such that I think too much energy is required in order to sustain it. That's what I've already covered. And what I've been indicating is that replacing fossil fuels and nuclear, certainly nuclear fission, we should have a program of renewable, non-polluting sources. And that efficiently we could get 50% more work out of the energy we do use, so that the fastest way to get new sources of energy is to use it efficiently. The best way to get a new supply of energy is to use it efficiently. And we simply could get a lot more work out of our energy. And thirdly, we use a lot of energy because our lifestyle is such that for all kinds of reasons it requires us to use energy. We have a system, we have a way of life which spreads our families all over the globe. And it's that way of life. We have a way of life which most work is fairly meaningless. And we buy things and travel and do all kinds of things in order to find meaning. In fact, I almost didn't use the energy to come here because there's so much meaning in my life in Chicago. During the 5 years I was in the 6 years I was in the Freedom Movement, I left Chicago once, and that was for the Freedom Movement to go to Houston. there wasn't any point to going anywhere. Everything that was meaningful and significant was happening right there, and our lives just were so full that we all, there wasn't any point to it. There wasn't any point to using a lot of energy. There wasn't any point to having so many of the things. We were involved in life, in meaning. And of course, you can't recreate the 60s, they all say. But I'm now finding another way to recreate the 60s in a somewhat different way. Well, now, that's what I've been saying, and you're very welcome to raise questions about that in the question period. But I wanted to go on to kind of talk today about the responses to these issues. What do we do then in the light of energy as a moral, political, and religious issue? Chiefly what I'm going to deal today with is a political program that I worked out for dealing with these issues. That is a program at the national level. That in that sense, the only way it can be actualized is for the polity, the government, or the governmental agencies, both local, state, and national, to do something about it. But the first thing that I want to talk about today, very briefly, is a moral response. That is a response, I think, of morality is something which has to do with our own individual lives and the way we approach things. It's not where we're dealing with the institutions, although we deal with the institutions when we deal morally. So what I call a moral response, and we might debate whether it's moral, political, or religious. Personally, we can begin to use different kinds of energy, and to use energy more efficiently, and to participate in economic and political processes that move toward the encouragement of such energy practices. And there are all kinds of inventories and illustrations of the kind of actions that are possible. Now, some people are really in a position to use solar energy, either in retrofitting their houses, or in the rehabilitation of buildings, or in new construction. I have here a solar study of how you rehabilitate a 20-apartment building done by some architects. And we're hoping to use these architects to retrofit or rehabilitate a building which our church is now, or a group in our church, we're not quite sure the church will buy it, but if they don't, we will, for our church. And other people are in positions within churches, businesses, schools, clubs, unions, or other institutions, so they can influence actions. In some cases, wind power might be used. We had a researcher in a recent conference I was in who said there are 300 quadrillion BTUs potential wind power. We use 75 quadrillion BTUs. There's four times as much potential power in the wind as we use energy in 1 year. That is, and that's a renewable resource. And money is available for this experimentation. These architects are building their own houses by their own hands using solar and all the kinds of techniques with overhanging roofs and building them into the sides of hills or putting banks of dirt on, you know, all the things that are possible. And they are planning, of course, in this building. I don't know where we're going to put it because of the solar window. But a big greenhouse, so we can grow our own plants, grow our own food. Money is available for some of this experimentation through the Department of Energy. And it's not a lot of money, of course, but there's a 6-state area which just notified us that there's $1 million for experimentation. We're hoping to get a little piece of this for this building we're doing. In other words, there are a lot of kinds of things individuals can do in using solar energy and in using wind power. I've talked to people who have windmills, and they are feeding energy back into the energy grid. Creates a problem for the power company, but those problems I don't think are insurmountable if there's a will. All the technology that these architects are using in their own home is very simple and very available. It doesn't take high-powered professional people, they say, and the processes and materials are very simple. Some people are reestablishing fireplaces and other wood-burning heating units as a means of reducing their dependency on oil, gas, and electricity. All of these possibilities, of course, are very, very relative and limited by where you are and what your situation is. But I know of no situation where some of this is not possible. In the city of Chicago now, they're experimenting with all kinds of greenhouses on the tops of buildings, which give you a kind of blanket in terms of insulation, and all kinds of solar possibilities. Down at the farm, the ranch where I was, Ghost Ranch, Presbyterian Ranch, they have 4 solar houses. We're going to have solar up here. We're using, what, $18,000 a year worth of oil and diesel here. We're going to generate electricity from our free water in order to run batteries that run the buses and the trucks around here and things. All these things are possible on the part of individuals and institutions. And I think we have a kind of moral responsibility for moving in this direction. That assumes, of course, that energy is a real issue in the way I have depicted it. Now, let me suggest my political program, or my big national program. And first I want to deal with the efficient use of energy, and then I want to deal with the sources of energy. Roughly speaking, I'm trying to develop a program on the part of the government which will encourage us, mostly by incentives, but not only by incentives, to use less energy, and where possible to use the market system, although some people prefer to use a direct interference and control on the part of the government, such as they have, for example, with the automobile manufacturers, which are required now by 1985 to have a fleet of cars that they produce with an average of 27.5 miles per gallon. Now, somebody was telling me who's here that there's an engine which will retrofit any car and get, what would you say, 70, 80, 90, 100 miles per gallon. We have that technology now. And you may want to say something about it. And the question is, what kind of a national policy can you get which would encourage the adoption of that technology and discourage or prevent the killing of that technology by forces that profit by not developing it? First, then, I want to get the more efficient use of energy, and I consider first the transportation sector. How do we get the transportation sector? We are now spending about $45 billion a year to import oil. That upsets our balance of payments. It makes the dollar worth what it is around the world, and there's no reason for it. In my program, we will be using less than we're producing domestically in oil by 2000. There's no question about it that if we move with the will, we could eliminate a great deal of that purchase of foreign oil. The question is, what is our will? And I'm not really dealing with the political problem of how you get this program implemented. All I'm saying is, there are possible programs if we had the political will to reduce the amount of energy in the transportation sector. And the aim is to increase the mileage per gallon of gasoline for cars and trucks, to increase the use of railroads. We had the highway fund to redo our railroads. Think of what we might get. Decrease the use of airplanes for intermediate range travel, and to increase the availability of public transportation generally. To that end, a tax on gasoline should be instituted by the federal government in addition to the general energy tax. And at the point I wrote this, I might even want to increase this. I said I would try 25 cents per gallon immediately and plan to increase it and have it publicly known that the tax would increase perhaps to 75 cents a gallon or a dollar a gallon or maybe even more periodically, so that people would know that they're just going to pay more for gasoline. If you increased it over a period of years, at least you give people a chance to adjust to it and buy the Toyota instead of a bigger car, because they would know what the future would be going to mean in terms of gasoline prices. I would also tax the purchases of a heavy new car with specified mileage ratings. That is to say, I would put $1,000 or $2,000 on the cars that get 20 miles or less or something like that. I would just make it economically desirable to get more mileage. I just think we could get more mileage, and we need to get it, and it's not simple because we have a hard time with our Toyota now, with Paul and all his stuff coming from Chicago here. I'd provide a tax credit for the purchase of cars with very high mileage ratings. Actually, if you got 40 or 50, say if they got 50 miles per gallon, give them a tax credit, and that would encourage the kind of introduction of savings. Now, I know there are all kinds of technologies that would increase the mileage of cars. I've read about it all over. I don't know all the technical stuff. Use aluminum engines. Costs a little more energy-wise to produce aluminum, and a little more for the car to use aluminum, but you could do it. And you save what? You save 400 or 500 pounds in your car, depending a little on how big a car you get. Well, I'd go on and do, different things for buses. I'd be a little easier on buses in terms of gasoline tax. Maybe have no tax on buses in order to encourage on the gasoline that's used in buses. I would tax air transportation, especially under 500 miles. Air transportation is the most expensive in terms of the energy. And there are all kinds of tables which show this. Now let me speculate about some of the possible savings from this. If we have over 90 million cars now, which number we might assume to increase at least 15 million by 2000, we don't know what the whole ethos is going to do about the two-car family and so forth, and the price of energy and all that. I know one family in the Community of Christ, or several families, where John and Mary Schramm were they three families reduced their number of cars to two, cooperated and reduced their use of the cars to 40% of what they used before. It was just the cooperation and the sensitivity to it. They reduced the number of miles. This Larry Rasmussen kept the books on. He said, reduce the number of miles they drove to 40%, and of course reduced the car. I don't know, but I'm sure that we could reduce the usage in all kinds of ways. So I'm calculating now that we'll have 15 more million cars, 105 million then by 2000. And I've calculated that if we got 30 miles per gallon, we'd save 0.83 billion barrels over what we are using now. 90 million cars are using about 1.65 billion barrels at present. That's equivalent to 4.8 quadrillion BTUs of energy. But if you save 0.83 billion barrels, then you save that much in terms of import, that much in terms of expenditure. And depending on what you calculate can be saved by the use of electricity in cars, by the use of alcohol. Brazil is now producing quantities of alcohol. They have cars that drive on 95% alcohol, 5% water. Most of the technicians say that our present cars could take up to 20% alcohol. Alcohol is about the same energy. There are all kinds of differentials, but the total energy output and work, I'm told, is about the same as gasoline. And in Brazil, it costs against $1.50 for gasoline. There are all kinds of ways then which we could save energy. And I calculate that by 2000, we could cut our gasoline consumption by half, or by 4 million barrels per day, or by 1.46 billion barrels, and then we'd save at $15 a barrel, and it probably will be higher, we'd save $21.9 billion in our payment abroad. That's only to indicate the kind of meaning of a policy, a national policy, which would move in the direction of efficient use of gasoline. In the residential sector, we could discourage the use of electricity. Electricity is the most inefficient energy we use, because you get about 33%, 31%, varying figures, efficiency. In other words, if you burn the oil or the gas in your kitchen stove, is over against electrical stove, you get about twice as much. Actually, the electricity loses about 66% of its efficiency in the transmission and in the generation. In Sweden, they generate heat in connection with the generation of electricity, and they get 24% heat, 24% of the energy or the work comes off as heat, whereas we don't get anything because we just let that heat go off into the air and let it, or go off into the water. They have what they call cogeneration, where you generate heat and electricity together and use the heat that's given off in the generation of electricity. There are all kinds of things we could do in that, in moving toward more efficient use in the residential. And you know all the things, insulation and the way you build the house and all of this. And what I would do in order to get this actualized is to, again, use tax credits and low-interest loans provided for insulation. But what I'm trying to do is get incentives, what's called the incentive way or the disincentive way, either tax if you use high-energy technologies or use a lot of energy, and support for your use of low-energy technologies and practices. And certainly for all the governmental, federal, state, and local projects, you could have, without the imposition on the public generally, you could have standards. And a great deal of the money, as you now know, is spent in our governmental agencies. So without imposing on us, the government itself, if it willed it, could build its buildings with solar and to have certain insulation requirements and so forth. I'd also increase, you know, I'd have electrical rates that would increase rapidly after reasonable amounts. I'm for the lifetime kind of electrical rate for people where you get a certain amount at a low rate and then you increase it afterwards in order to discourage the use of electricity. I think electrical houses are completely immoral to build. Now, once you got them, there's nothing you can do really but kind of live with them, and there's no problem, but to think of doing, you know, of consciously choosing that, it seems to me is going the wrong way. And some people say I shouldn't say it's immoral. It's kind of moralistic, they say. It's really kind of irresponsible to do it that way. Now, I figure in the residential area, we use 16.3 quadrillion BTUs in 73. And so I figured out here, and I got the figures in terms of how many houses we could retrofit, how many new houses would come into existence. And on the basis of that, I say if we had 63 million units using about 16.3 quads in 70, we could save 80% on 20 million units. In other words, with solar and insulation, we'd save 80% of what we were using in 1970 on those 20 million units, we would say 4.14 quadrillion BTUs. And without solar insulation and heat pumps and all this efficient stuff, I think we could save up to 40%, you know, of our energy in the housing area. Now, I don't know any way to calculate the effects of higher prices and incentives on efficiency, but I'm assuming by 2000, these 20 million units would operate with 80% saving, The other 68 million units, I assume 65% of the fuel used in 70. In other words, I assume that all units will use less, and therefore we'll make an additional saving. It's probably enthusiastic, you know, to think that we're going to save, what is it? I calculate, instead of saving about 50%, which my figures might lead me, that instead of the 16 quad, we'll use about 11 quad in our residential area. But this would be a real saving, and instead of projecting, as many people do, the increase in the use of energy in the residential area and in all other areas, you see, I'm predicting that we could actually decrease the amount of energy. And there are many, many studies coming out now that indicate that. Actually, I'm figuring on about 100 quads of energy, quadrillion BTUs, that is, by 2000. And some studies I've seen by very, very able people and all the technical qualities that I don't have indicate we might go as low as 50 or 60 quads. We have a very aggressive program in the conservation of energy and the use of renewable, non-polluting sources of energy. Well, similarly, I go through the industrial and commercial sectors, and you get the same kind of program with tax credits, low-interest loans, increased rates for large users of electricity, the general tax on energy, and readjustment of transportation rates on scrap metals, because now it costs you more to transport scrap metals than it does new metals. It's a strange thing. So that the it does not encourage the recycling of metals. All kinds of things would be part of the program in order to encourage the efficient use of electricity. At any rate, I have projected in the commercial sector, industrial and commercial sector, about 39Q this is just for the commercial sector. I've projected about 39Q for 2000. Well, I go on, in the industrial, I have here 60, and that may be very high. But then I get a total then of about 99.3, or about 100 Q, that I think we will need with a program of tax incentives and encouragements and tax disincentives and all kinds of programs like the government imposing the mileage on the fleets of cars. We will reduce the amount that many projections indicate would be used if nothing is done. And the projections go all the way from about 70, if you have a very, very, very aggressive, to 170 for 2000, if you let things go the way they are. No, it's a very, very different story if you just let things go, as over against having a very, very aggressive program. Now, part of it will change, of course, depending on what the Arabs do in terms of the price of oil and what prices occur here. I am really for the deregulation of gas and all these things in order to increase the price. And if there's a problem in windfall profits, I'm for a wellhead tax so that the great profits that occur because companies own resources that really belong to everybody, it isn't that we would develop them without the initiative and the entrepreneurship, but the what's called windfall profits could be siphoned off by taxes at the source of supply and all kinds of devices. But if you got the price up to something like what it would be if it were not regulated, then it seems to me the incentives will be here to use it efficiently. And if you're, I've seen estimates which say by 2010 the price of energy will be four times Now, unless you have a lot of efficiency in your house that's heated by gas, and you think of four times your gas bill, you begin to realize what that means very concretely for you as a family. I really think that unless there is a tremendous push to change the energy practice and to change it through some national policy, we will have at least the doubling of energy prices in the next 20, 25 years. If no way out of it, seems to me. Well, then, what are we going to do? How are we going to get the energy? One of the problems is to reduce our use of energy, and the other problem is to, change the sources of our energy. Well, I've written a program, and it may be completely off base, although I tried it out at this seminar with a number of technicians present, and it didn't seem to be completely off base. In fact, one technician wrote his own program, which is really more optimistic in some ways than mine. So, how am I going to get this 100 Q of energy? First, I'm going to get 1 quadrillion BTUs out of the use of urban wastes. I'm going to get 4 quadrillion BTUs out of the use of forest and mill residues. We're going to make it into methane or into alcohol. Then I'm going to get, I'm going to follow a program that's been advocated by one researcher, which would take 175 million acres of unused land in this country where there's 20 inches of rainfall annually, and I'm going to develop a national program to plant trees on those 175. They aren't used for anything, not for grazing, recreation, nothing. He's done the research, chiefly in the central, between the Rockies and the Appalachian, 175 million acres. He claims you could get 17 Q. Then he's got the figures and figured out how big a farm you need and all that. And I figured from that program, by 2000, if pursued, we could get 10 Q. Then there's another program where a researcher has proposed a kelp farm in the Pacific Ocean. There's already an experimental program there sponsored by the American Gas Institute and the government. And they are growing kelp. Kelp grows about 4 or 5 feet a day. And you've got to develop some processes of bringing the bottom up and getting some circulation. But certainly you could combine that with thermal gradients and get some energy out of that. I mean, there's all kinds of things are possible. He claims you could get 22.5 quadrillion BTUs out of a kelp farm. 470 square miles. They're doing this off the coast of San Diego. And I've just used 7.5. I've been very pessimistic about the possibility of that size. Other people say there are a million acres of water hyacinths in Louisiana that ought to be used. I haven't figured anything for that. One researcher says that if we cut down on the protein chain and stopped eating beef and ate grains, we'd save 100 million acres. Now, you could debate whether we ought to use those 100 million acres for energy for ourselves or whether we ought to feed that into the granaries of the world with the grain prices what they are, according to the farmers I've been talking to recently. I don't know how you would do that, but the fact is, if we had the will, there is a possibility on those 100 million acres of 15 Q of energy. And I've said, well, you might get 5 or 10 out of that. So what I've figured then, using all of these what I call biomass sources, which you don't have any discussion of much, no money given to research much. They were debating whether to give 6 million or 9 million to this kind of research. Now, there's one problem with this kind of research that I didn't really face until recently. is that biomass gives off carbon dioxide, so you don't solve your problem of the carbon dioxide blanket and the lowering of the temperature because of the carbon dioxide blanket with this program. Now, I was really blithely in my ignorance assuming that since plants take in carbon dioxide that there would be a cycle. But they say it isn't an exact cycle, that more is given off than is taken in the growth process. I don't know the technical answer to that. That's where this becomes very technical. But without increasing the use of fuels which increase the carbon dioxide, by changing from fossil fuels to biomass, we could eliminate all of the other pollutants, at least, except carbon dioxide, and we reduce the amount of carbon dioxide, since clearly the plants are taking in some of the carbon dioxide. So my program is to get from bioconversion, what is called bioconversion, of the growing of organic matter, about 26.5 quadrillion BTUs by 2000. From wind, I'll get 6, from hydroelectric, 3, from geothermal, 5, from solar, 10, and that's very pessimistic, according to some people. From coal, I will get 22.5 quads, and that will require 900 million tons, and we're probably up to about 700 million now, so I'm not really advocating a great development of coal. Oil, I've got 2 billion barrels. We're now, in 76, we used 6.4 billion barrels. I really reduced the use of oil. And for gas, we're now using about 22 quads or 15 billion, or 22, because you get about one quad per billion cubic feet. I'm going to cut it down to 15 billion cubic feet. So I'm cutting the gas, cutting the oil, increasing the coal a little, and expecting biomass and wind and solar to take up the slack. The technician who made out can't find his sheet, it's somewhere here, was going to get 15 Q from solar by 2000. Now, of course, all of this is problematic. You'll get other people who say, well, by 2000, you'll be lucky to get 2 or 3 quadrillion BTUs out of solar. They really don't think it's a part of the future until way down the pike. And I don't know how you judge between those who are pessimistic and optimistic about these matters. So that what I've done then is to write a program which allows us to ignore nuclear. You didn't see any nuclear in there, and we're still going to have about 3 quad nuclear if we don't build any new plants by 2000. So I've got some leeway in case my biomass is just clear out of this world. And, well, that's the way it is, and where I sit. So without nuclear, and with a reduction in coal and oil, and the corresponding elimination completely of the $45 billion we're now spending on oil, abroad by 2000, and they question my mind if we willed it that we could have such a program. If we willed it, it may shift, you know, in terms of some of the dimensions where we would get it, but we could do it. And it might take some real inputs of research and development money, but when you think of what we have already put into other research and development for nuclear, for example, I figure our research and development on nuclear must be at least $60 billion by now. Development of all our weapons, you see, all that is back of our energy use. We put it in. If it was important, we put it in. And we have the money, if we will it, to put the research and development into processes which would simply provide us with non-renewable, less polluting sources of energy. I mean, with renewable, less polluting sources of energy. And I haven't developed a big technology, particularly on the solar either. I really am against that, partly for the political consequences of having satellites off in space, and the kind of power it would give the people who control those satellites is somewhat frightening to me. Well, that's my program then, the political program. And I just wanted to say a word or two about the program that responds to the religious issue. I don't know how you develop a different way of being or a different lifestyle, but I'm convinced it's one of the key issues for the church is to begin to try to embody a different way of being from what is dominant in this country. And I guess I'd say this regardless of the energy issue. The energy issue just raises the question. You know, you could raise it from the point of view of mental health, for example. You could say, what is it about our culture which produces so much mental ill health? You could go into almost any area, drug addiction, all kinds of issues, and say lawlessness, crime, all that. What is it about our culture? And you come to the same conclusion, it seems to me, namely that there's something basically about our way of being which is destructive. It's not unambiguously destructive, but it is very destructive. And my prediction is it'll get more destructive. And whether it be energy, you see, in order to get this kind of an energy program, you really have to challenge the position that a lot of people are in. If you begin to think of the people who are dependent on the present oil industry, if you cut the oil industry back to one-third of what it is now, there are 290,000 gasoline dealers in this country. And you take all the people who supply all of the things that are involved in the processing of oil and gasoline, and all the transportation, you begin to get into a whole network of people whose livelihoods, and Don rightly brought up the other day, what do you do with the system? I once preached a sermon in the church, and I looked it out about seven mink stoles in the congregation, and I said, you know, if people stop buying things that they didn't use and that gave them chiefly a kind of psychic status, good feeling, and some of that is probably necessary, I said you'd have economic chaos. You would. If you start following my program today, if everybody stopped buying things today, and all things we buy are energy intensive. And last time, some of you remember, I read you a list of how much energy you use in everything you buy. It isn't only the direct forms of energy that are involved. And I have a whole list here of the amounts of energy that are involved in whatever you buy. Any service. You eat out, and it uses so many thousand BTUs per dollar that you spend. You buy clothing. Women's and children seems to be more energy intensive than men. I don't know why that is, but it's not very much. You're not saved by the difference. Well, my contention is that there are now numerous communities and networks which encourage lifestyles which are less energy demanding. And I think our churches and church people have the potential for moving in this direction. Right now it's the ecologists. When I go to the ecology meetings, and occasionally I get invited for one reason or another, or go just to listen, you find a kind of new spirit that's not interested in things and in the expansion of consumption. Enough is enough. And I don't know why or what caused a person to get to this point, because it's a kind of miracle or mystery why some people fall into that bag, and I suppose a psychologist would have reasons for it, and some of us continue on the other way. And I'm not saying that that it's virtuous to fall into the bag of a new lifestyle. In a way, I'm saying it's necessary. For me, it seems necessary in order for us to be. I don't want to get caught in the system I've been involved in with my son Paul, and I don't know what to do. And the only thing I know to do is to begin to form within our church a covenantal community which will somehow embody a different way of being, which will be a kind of extended family, which will care for each other very concretely. Hopefully there'll be some babysitters there. And where the elderly will be taken care of, where they won't have to move into homes until, you know, there's a time when you can't take care of them, but way beyond what people can do. And the life will be so stimulating that elderly will not get elderly nearly as fast, where there'll be all of this care for the earth and the use of materials, where you'll have one set of tools in a room for everybody, and where you know, you begin to use less because somehow you're living as a community group. Now, our group is not very interested in moving too radically in this direction. Everyone seems to want an apartment and to live and to do our things out of that kind of private existence, so we have the best of both worlds. But that's why we're buying the apartment building. We hope to buy some other buildings. We hope to bring our church people into some possible relation to each other, so there's a big enough mass, so if necessary we have our own school, so if necessary we have our own alternate school kind of thing. Holden had here $2,400 a year, and you came if you couldn't make it in college, you didn't know why you were going to college. You would do the interpretation in your own community of what's the meaning of education. And then if you needed to get some technical education, you can milk a public university. Because all the meanings that we hope will come out of sending kids to St. Olaf or Concordia or some other place where you know, you just hope that the college will do what you haven't been able to do and give them all that vision and hope and life and faith will come out of the community. But it won't come out of a community, I think, until a community deals with the whole of our being, education, housing, jobs. So many people I meet who are unhappy in their jobs. What are you going to do? I don't know. I don't know what you're going to do. A guy who's working in Burlington, Vermont, is that the town? At any rate, for General Electric, making guns, and he doesn't want to make guns. It is really opposed to his whole way of being, but he's caught. Three kids, education, thinking of college, all this kind of stuff. What are you going to do? I say, got to find a way of being where you don't need college at $6,000 to $8,000 a year, where somehow the whole of life is possible without the expensive services and the expensive things. And it's only possible if there's a joyful way of being which is an alternative. You can't lecture. You can't preach. You got to embody it. You got to find a way of being which is so attractive that people want to live in it, want to do it. And everybody won't want to do it. But that's my sense of the response to the religious issue. That is the issue of the meaning of our being, which is part of the energy issue and part of all the other issues of our culture. Well, I think I've said enough.
I have a sort of a reaction. Regardless of what the plan is and what's behind it in this type of thing, it seems to me that in order for any plan to be implemented, the consumer, let's say, has to be convinced that there's a need for that program. And I think that being, let's say, outside of the thing, you think in terms of many of us, the big push to conserve on electricity, this type of thing. And so the institution I teach and part of, we reduced our electric use by 50%, yet our bill went up almost 25%. And so we said, well, the heck, you know, we're a public agency. I think that there's a skepticism that comes with that. I think it's a very serious economic issue. Tax incentives, slap a surtax on everything, that's maybe something that will persuade us to say go with something a little less consuming. But on the other hand, the companies are going to get theirs too. So I think it's an extremely inflationary plan. That's one aspect of it. I don't think that as a nation, or even as a, say, a medium-sized city, the people will buy it. I think back to last summer, I have a home on an island, and on that island, we had an acute water shortage. And there wasn't really a lot of, let's say, conservation of water until the reservoir got down to 150 acre feet. And then all of a sudden, a law was passed, and we were allotted 80 gallons per day for household. And the people realized that, hey, that is a necessity. We can see the reservoir. It's tangible. This year, after the spring rains, the reservoir is still overflowing. But we find people are not using any more water than they did last May, or a year ago May, when we were put on that rationing plan. But people saw the necessity of it. They have that object lesson, that tangible thing. And, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, this plan that you have, I really see it as A, inflationary, and B, I don't see anything outside of a small, well-defined community accepting it. Until it's really impressed upon.
I'm not going to say much now, so.
I really wonder about the economic incentive that is raising costs and taxes. We've seen since the early 70s at least a doubling in the price of gasoline. But we've also seen a halving of the price of the value of the dollar. And I think there's a direct correlation. And even with the prices of fuel going up and up, I don't see any fewer campers on the freeways. I don't see any less boats going out to the rivers on the weekends. And I wonder about the recessiveness of the poor. I work in a large suburban area, and with the affirmative action programs, with the companies that have fled to the suburbs, and now the affirmative action programs where the blacks are drawn out of the ghettos, they use their cars to commute to these suburban industries, and when you increase the price of energy, they can't get there. I wonder where a program, number one, of a moral education, I believe that the energy issue very deeply is a moral one. And a system of allocation, where it's not, the amount of energy an individual has is not dependent on how much money he has.
Well, we've got three issues, it seems to me. One is whether or not people will accept this, maybe there are more issues, accept this program, you know, on the basis of economic incentives. We've got the inflationary aspect of it. We've got the effect on the poor. Which other one do we got? We've got at least three basic issues. I guess all I'll say about whether or not people will accept it, I've not dealt with the political problem of getting it implemented. I've tried to indicate what seemed to me to be a desirable program for the country, and so I haven't dealt with that. Secondly, I wonder if anybody has a response, before I give mine, to the problem of how you deal with the poor, because definitely my program will work a hardship on the poor. It's very clear. How do you deal with that? You have said you deal with it by rationing, and that's many people's response. That's one way of dealing with it. How else could you deal with it?
Well, under the plan that you're proposing, would possibly, if the surtaxes are enough. Well, the surtaxes, this added income to government, is plowed back as a way of doing it, although I think that's been somewhat of a failure in the attempts that our government's
Yeah, you could.
Subsidy.
But, you know, there.
Yeah, you could deal with the Lifeline program in heating and in electricity and in gasoline. Be a form of rationing in a way. They've tried it some places. I believe in the Lifeline program. Everybody ought to have a modest amount of gasoline and of electricity and of heating energy at a modest price. Beyond that, there ought to be a fairly, as I've said, a fairly steep increase in order to discourage it. So that's a very, the other thing I have asserted is that we ought not to take care of our problem of the poor. We ought not to let the problem of the lower income affect a needed program unless you got an alternative. Now, you've suggested rationing. I don't have any real problem with that. That might be the way to go.
I believe that energy, it really is a true resource and it belongs equally to all of us.
I do think we got to deal with the problem of the lower income and the effect of a program, any way energy goes, on lower income. I don't know how to deal with inflation generally. I mean, it is inflationary unless you can really cut the cost of energy. You said you cut it 50%, cost you 25% more, but still you save that 25%. If, you know, you save more than it cost you, did you not? I don't know whether you saved more. If you cut your energy use 50%.
Energy used by approximately 50%, but the cost for the energy that we're using.
Or the cost for the 20, for the 50% went up 25%. In other words, you didn't save enough to offset the cost.
No. So, the same thing happened in the water situation, if I may. Just got a 75% increase in rates this year.
Well, inflation is really a very, very vicious problem, a vicious reality in our society.
And it ties with what he was saying as far as...
But I think in the long run, if we continue with oil and these other things, it'll go up more now than it would otherwise. That's just a guess, of course. I don't know how you can predict that. It depends upon so many factors. You know, it depends a lot on what the Arabs decide to do and how we can influence what they do.
But isn't another aspect of the research, though, the tech, I think a great amount of that technology is there, and the research has been done. It's a matter of the capital from the private sector being invested in the development of these things.
That's right.
And
see, I would advocate government experimental programs like TVA to try to push in directions. And if we've got this carburetor or this thing we can do, which would increase our mileage on gasoline to 100 miles per gallon, then we're now getting, what, 12, 13 average, 14 average maybe? Well, you're going to seven times as much. That's clearly going to be deflationary, if that's true. I accept it as at least a 70% possibility since you report it from the Seattle Times. And they can't be completely moved. Yeah.
There is a real tension I can detect in my own family. I think a lot of us can. It's appearing because of it, as you've indicated, for various reasons, economically, we can't really cut back abruptly on the use of energy. But in the public school, they're doing a great job, in most districts, I think, impressing on children the need to curtail the use of energy. And but it's really funny. You see it happening. The kids come home from school and they get after you to turn off the lights and to not use energy, turn down the thermostat and use the car less and things like that. And yet the parents go on doing things just as they always have. And then by the time the kids reach a certain age, maybe high school or a little beyond, why, they'll probably turn out to be much like their parents. Somehow, they've been convinced and shown at an early age that this is an important issue and something should and can be done about it. But by the time they become adults, why, they have become weaned to the Madison Avenue approach of buying more things, go more places, drive your camper with a boat on top and a boat trailer on the back and a couple Honda motorbikes or snowmobiles on it, depending on the time of year. And you go on vacation and all that, and it's too big. Well, it's just an option.
Yeah. Can't, I don't think you can do it without an alternative that's more attractive.
The point is, the kids are very impressionable. As our adults, in the sense of rationing gas here in Marin County, they really, adults really came around.
To have an alternative that's more attractive requires a lot of energy. It requires a lot of energy for me to deal with Paul right now in alternatives to, I just think, turn on a television. He watches the television at 4 months. I think, man, I can just turn that on. He's got, you know, I would be free from it. It takes a lot of energy, a lot of freedom, a lot of conviction that there's some things that are important that we didn't think were important. I think. And that requires that we withdraw from the system. We work 30 hours a week at the most, and we withdraw partially from the system. We have the time to develop an alternative lifestyle. A whole array, it's just a whole gamut of things that are required. And
yeah, it really takes a lot of effort. I know that, say, in some of the youth work kinds of activities I do, and every time I've come into a new church, that and I've always come in not on top of somebody else, but as a new direction in that parish's concern. It takes a process of time and so much more energy. Because first off, you've got to plan what it's going to be so it is attractive, and then help them to have some positive experiences with it. And then eventually, they start, you know, now, say 2 years in this place I'm presently at, they now, when you sit down and plan to do something, very seldom do they talk about money things anymore. It's, you know, can we do this, can we do that? And it finally comes through that there are better alternatives than going and sitting in the theater as a group activity. But the same thing, you've got to present them with the alternative. And I think that's what you're saying is, how can we show them, you know, that it is? Like if you went and said, you want to go to Las Vegas, honey, or you want to go to Holden Village for a week, you know, and we're set up, the first reaction, let's go where all the neon lights are and all that, you know. But if you can sneak them up here for a week, all of a sudden they maybe don't want to go to Las Vegas anymore. Now, how do you do that in the energy circle, I think, is really questions maybe we need to be
asking. Well, I think they're part and parcel of the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you are reducing the use of energy by providing an alternative lifestyle.
Yeah, right.
And I don't say it for the sake of energy. Actually, I think the energy crisis for me is a great alternative, a great opportunity to think about, it's a great gift to think about some alternative ways of living which are more meaningful anyway, I think. You know, for me, let me get confessional. I don't want to lay this trip on anybody except myself, really. My wife says I'm always laying trips on her. Poor Paul. What is he going to grow up with?
I'd be an energy czar.
He'd probably react. Well, it's time to go for lunch, I think, so why don't we break officially, and some of you want to stay around. I think Paul will be here soon, so but I'll still talk. So it raises the issue, I think, of the meaning of our being. And that is really, I guess, the fundamental reason we're here at Holden, is to think about that, share a little, and try a little.
Do you think there's a reason, I'm a human anatomist, and do you think there's a reason, maybe, why God created this machine, us, which are probably the most inefficient, as far as utilization of the energy to be derived from the food. We're talking about 67% utilization in some of these ways of recycling and so forth. We're talking about under 50% in the case where I'm somewhere.
I think a lot of that's though the way you live.
No.
General animal existence, though, that they have much inefficiency
in the cell, as far as
the cellular
take of the energy and that energy that we utilize
So we're not any worse than an elephant or a meat.
Basically the same, yeah.
Life just must be inefficient.
There's a small variation, but I think it's the energy cycle. Most of it's going off the speed.
Well, if everyone would just stand close together, then you...
No, that's all we're going to tell you. I melt single fingers, but I don't really know.
It's very...
But it's been something that's bothered me a little bit.
It's very interesting. I don't know what species of bird, maybe all species, but birds in the winter will find a hollow, some birds, and then 25 or 30 will be in that hollow, and they'll actually shift, according to students, during the night, so that there's a different layer on the outside. It continually shifts. Now, you're talking about biological kind of, but that community of heat, you know, I guess in a sense I'm talking about that community of being, which would use life and conserve, and it's the same way if you build apartments. If you build apartments in a square where with a lot of common walls, you conserve a heck of a lot of energy as over against if you build them with all open wall. I mean, it's just a fact structurally. If you build your apartments like the birds sleep, you conserve the energy. Now, you know, it's a question of different kinds of values all the time. My whole thrust is to reduce the amount of money that's required of me so I don't have to do what I don't want to do, what I don't really find joy in doing, and therefore can reduce the necessity to a kind of minimal level, and then I can do what I want to do. And having retired, I got rid of, and I haven't missed my job ever since I retired. And now I'm working at the church for $3,000 a year, and I work 30, 40 hours a week if I want to. I'm only required, not even required, but I call to work 15 hours a week, 9 months a year. And I can do what I want. And I do it all with a kind of joy. But I couldn't do that if I hadn't retired and therefore get some money from a few places, so little money. And if I hadn't retired psychologically and spiritually from the rat race, from the great drive to make and shape and be in control and be powerful and important and all the things that drove me to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day for years. And I don't know, some good things come out of that. And I don't say it's a simple kind of choice, but it's certainly much more ambiguous than I ever thought it was. And I'm now experiencing what it means to retire from the system and to do what I do with a kind of freedom and abandon and joy and choose it. But I still got to, especially with inflation, I really got to control the expenditures or I won't be able to live very long on my income. So I'll be right back in the rat race, or Sarah will have to go to work or something. Right now, neither one of us has to work, so what we do because of joy. And boy, I think our faith, in a sense, giving you my Monday night sermon now, our faith is a response to what God has done for us and is doing for us that frees us somehow to find those things that we really want to attend to. And we do it with a kind of abandon and freedom because it's joyful. How you do that and earn a living, that's... And I just, again, I fall into these things. I'm in a very giftful situation because I've retired. I can attend to Paul. I never could attend to my first family, four kids. Never could attend to them. Even if I was present, I was always psychologically somewhere else with a great program I had for my own career, with a great involvement in teaching, contributing greatly, a great involvement in the freedom movement. That was really ambiguous. My youngest daughter was in her senior year. Said, I lost my father to the freedom movement. It was a good cause. You know, it's very ambiguous. I don't. There's no simplicity, but I have a kind of freedom now that I'm just confessing it. And I kind of wish for a lot of people. I don't know how you get it. And you see young people who don't know where they're going, And you really wonder whether they ought to buy into one of these career patterns and get caught in that. But if they don't, where do they go? Where do you go? Man, I don't know what I'd do.
You know, but it's funny that you mention that, because I think both Elmer and this morning, and even Lathrop in his thing on worship, sort of hit that, as far as he was talking about Romans and, you know, knowing God and putting him first, and then not worrying about having other things. And Lathrop and worship and saying, you know, you have to go ahead and go for it, even though you know it's the quest, and not let it become overly important. So to have that freedom and yet enjoy the
still,
fight.
You're still, your yeah. being requires you be.
Yeah, right.
The question is, what do you be?
Yeah.
Well, because you got to earn a living. I say you got to find something significant. It's got to kind of fit your talents, and you got to earn a living. You know, it's just clear how you put all that together.
Be farmers.
Farmers, you know.
They're happy when they watch it grow.
I just came from a farmer who said he was losing money on every crop he was growing this year.
That's freedom, see?
He's also only working 40% of what he used to work because he got free up here. And he's in the state legislature, you know, he's found another way. But I don't want to keep anybody from that lunch if you're going.